Welcome to AI at Work, a podcast which is part of the Tech Talks network. And in this podcast, we're going to venture into the transformative influence of artificial intelligence inside the workplace. And our discussions will focus on both the remarkable breakthroughs, but also the complex challenges of integrating AI into our everyday business functions and workflows. A quick question for you all. What happens when someone who has spent four decades quietly shaping the foundations of modern AI then decides it's time to speak publicly about where this technology is heading, what worries him, what he believes must change before it's too late, and why he's so excited about that road ahead? That is the conversation that is waiting for you inside today's episode with Dr. Craig Kaplan, founder and CEO of the IQ Company. And he's a rare voice that brings genuine experience to the debate around AGI, safety, and the decisions that we're making at a global level. And while the world rushes ahead with systems built on training processes and on opaque training processes and a handful of people that are writing ethical constitutions for 8 billion people on this planet, Craig has a very different view. He's going to argue today that future intelligence should be intentionally designed, built on transparency and collective human judgment, rather than just the values of a select few. And his commitment to blending human insight with advanced AI is both bold and grounded in decades of real work that have included running Project Wall Street, which was a remarkable experiment in collective intelligence that outperformed some of the most experienced traders on Wall Street. So if you've been wondering of how we can build AI that reflects each and every one of us rather than just the loudest voices in the room, this is a conversation that I hope will stay with you long after this podcast ends. As you all know, I often talk to founders and business leaders who spend months building incredible products. But it's easy to forget how that one overlooked login or unsecured Wi-Fi connection can bring everything crashing down. That's where NordLayer comes in. It's a business security platform built for the modern hybrid team. No hardware, no complicated rollout, just a simple toggle-ready solution that lets you secure your entire network in minutes. And it does this by combining VPN, access control and threat protection so your people can connect safely from any device and any network and anywhere. So whether you're 5 people or 500, you can scale it within a few clicks and sleep better knowing that your data's protected by the same team behind NordVPN. So if you've been putting off network security because it feels too technical or too expensive, don't wait any longer. Please visit nordlayer.com/techtalksdaily and use the coupon code techdaily-28 for 28% off your plan. So enough from me. Time for me to officially introduce you to my guest today. So a massive warm welcome to the show. Can you tell everyone listening a little about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Neil, great to be here. My name's Craig Kaplan. I'm the CEO of IQ Company and the founder of superintelligence.com. And I've been working in AI since the 1980s. So have a lot of experience in designing and implementing intelligent systems.
And it's so refreshing to hear you saying that. You know, you've been working in AI long before the current wave of excitement and FOMO. You're doing it before it was cool. So I mean, let's have a look at how quickly the field is pushing towards AGI this year. What stands out to you as the greatest source of concern or maybe even the greatest source of possibility? It seems to be quite a divisive topic right now, but where do you stand on this race for AI, AGI that we're in now?
Sure. So I'm a big fan of AI because it's been my passion for so many years. At the same time, I've discovered that sort of the longer you've been in the field and the more you know about it, generally, the more concerned you also need to be. So I see existential risks. I share concerns along with Jeff Hinton and others that very advanced forms of AI really pose an existential threat. And at the same time, I think the 80% likelihood is that it's going to be fantastic and make all of our lives better and more productive. So it's an interesting way to live, sort of holding both viewpoints. But I think that's really the truth. Everything is probabilistic. Everyone's moving very rapidly towards AGI. In fact, I've noticed, and perhaps you have as well, in the conversation these days, it used to be artificial general intelligence, AGI was sort of the holy grail, and folks have now just leaped right past that to superintelligence, which is interesting. I think it says something about sort of the growing awareness of how advanced these systems are becoming.
And I've got to ask, I mean, it seems every tech leader has got their own opinion, and Elon Musk was even placing bets with other tech leaders. How far away is AGI, before we leapfrog AGI, how far away is it, do you think?
So a lot depends on the definition. Sort of a commonly accepted definition is AGI is a system that can do kind of any cognitive task that a human can do as well as the average human. Yeah. And there, if you ask me for a guess, I'd say we're 3 to 5 years away. And it could be sooner. And when I've listened to other folks in the field, the consensus ranges, the range is some folks, Sam Altman has recently taken to saying we're already there, because if you go back 5 years in time and look at GPT, you'd say this was AGI. So there's that point of view. But also, at Google and other places, people are saying maybe, you know, by the end of the decade or a few more years. So it's not going to be long. We don't have a lot of time to sort of get used to this idea, and it's coming very quickly.
And of course, many current alignment frameworks rely on constitutions written by pretty much a small group of researchers. And one of the things that attracted me to you is you argue that this is creating blind spots in both ethics and design. So how did you arrive at this belief that alignment should draw on the collective intelligence of millions rather than just the guidance of a few? It feels a very refreshing response here, but tell me more about that.
Sure. A couple of things there. So first on constitutional AI. So this was an idea. I think Anthropic was one of the first companies that came out with it. They had a paper talking about the idea of a small group. They didn't emphasize the small group part, but humans writing a constitution, a set of rules for AI, and then other AIs using that set of rules to sort of test new models. And it really evolved from this problem that these models required so much testing, it was sort of overwhelming human ability to, you know, comprehensively test them. So a more efficient and scalable way of handling that problem would be to write the rules and then have AI test AI. And I had a couple of issues with that. First of all, I like Anthropic as a company. I think they do have a very good set of values, as far as I can tell. But the idea that AI is overseeing the ethics of AI, there's just something a little disturbing about that. And then further, the fact that the set of rules is written by such a small, you know, by definition, a small group of people in one company is also a little disturbing, because it seems unlikely that that would be representative of the values of all the people on the planet. There's 8 billion of us, many different cultures. And so the approach that I've sort of come to, and it's rooted in the experience I had running a company called Predict Wall Street for 14 years, which was based on the collective intelligence of humans. So that company, very briefly, basically got opinions from millions of humans of kind of just average intelligence, you and me. And, you know, we're not stock experts or anything like that, just maybe dabbled and bought a couple of shares here and there. But nevertheless, in aggregate, when you got input from millions of humans and then properly processed that information, we designed a system that could beat the very best guys on Wall Street. It powered a hedge fund, traded a couple billion dollars worth of trades, and actually ranked in the top 10. So to me, that was not just theoretical, an idea that maybe collective intelligence could be a path, but actually proof. It took a long time, but we actually built that system over 14 years. And we had a scorecard. Wall Street, very competitive field. So the appeal with regards to AI of collective intelligence is not only that you can have many entities, in this case, it might be AI entities as well as human entities working together to do very difficult things, but also if each of those AIs were personalized with our values. So for example, Neil, if you personalized an AI and it had not only your expertise, but also your ethics and your values, and I did the same, and millions of people did the same, then we would have sort of a network of these entities, in this case, AIs, that would be reflective, broadly reflective of the values and representative of the values of many different humans, many different cultures, sort of a democratic approach. And I felt like this is a much safer and better way to sort of get ethics into an AI system. It's more representative, the power is decentralized, and yet you don't sacrifice the intelligence because, as I mentioned with Predict Wall Street, we've shown that such systems can actually outperform the very best humans.
Wow, what's such a great example of collective intelligence there. And if you go back for a moment to your time with Predict Wall Street and that length of time producing that collective intelligence and that measurable impact that you produced, I'm curious, what were the biggest lessons that you learned along the way during that time that have maybe helped you pave the way forward now?
Well, one thing that's important, I think, and relevant to sort of the AI safety discussion and AI ethics, is that all of this input from humans, there's going to be a wide diversity of opinions, and there's value in that. So for example, if you think about Wall Street, each individual investor doesn't know that much. They may know only one or two stocks and how they feel about those stocks. The pros on Wall Street are covering many, many stocks, but across millions of people, the collective brain power covers the universe of stocks in a way much better than any human expert can. And so sort of overcoming the limits of bounded rationality is the technical term. So my old advisor at Carnegie Mellon, where I got my PhD, Herbert Simon, he was one of the pioneers of AI. He got his Nobel Prize for, in part, the idea of bounded rationality, that humans are limited in how much information they can process. But when you have a group, especially a very large group with millions of individuals or millions of entities, across that group, you overcome the limits of that bounded rationality. You can process much more information than any human can. You can kind of cover the waterfront, as it were. And that's very powerful in terms of solving tasks. So I think that's one lesson. Another lesson is just the importance of data. So at my company, Predict Wall Street, before I sold it in 2020, really the value, as with many Silicon Valley companies, yes, we had a system for getting an edge on Wall Street and we're able to trade and everything, but the value that was powering that was all this data that we had gathered from millions of individuals. Similarly, with AI, most of these companies, if you wonder why is it sometimes free to use these large language models? Well, it's just a vacuum cleaner sucking, you know, data from all of the users. And that data is really, really important. The reason that's important for AI safety is that I think most of us aren't aware everything we do is being used to train these models, including sort of how our behavior reflects ethically. If we're behaving well online, that pattern of good behavior is being used to train the AIs. On the flip side, if we behave not so well, that is also being used to train the AIs. And so it's almost like with a small child, if you're a parent or there's parents out there, they absorb everything you do, and you have to sort of, you learn as a parent that, okay, I have to be more careful because I'm a role model all the time and I'm not used to that. But that's how it is with AI. We are role models for AI, and especially when it comes to ethics and safety, how we behave really does matter.
And it's so interesting because I think in recent years, businesses have finally woken up to the problem of having, I don't know, a meeting room full of middle-aged dudes in white shirts. It causes such a problem because if you're going to serve, meaningfully serve your audience or your customers, you need diversity of thought and you need that same diversity as your customers. So I think that collective intelligence is so important and so much more important than the loudest voice in a meeting room. And that's one of the things that stood out to me about IQ Company, because again, you're exploring ways to combine human judgment with advanced AI to create systems that serve humanity as a whole. So I love what you're doing here, but what does all this look like in practice? And what have you learned about designing systems where humans play an active role rather than that supervisory one?
So a couple things. So one, I want to sort of hone in on the word design, because that's very, very important. Especially, I keep bringing things back to the safety piece, not because I'm not excited about the prospects, I am, but just because maybe this is Wall Street training. You always learn risk management. So, I mean, folks like Jeff Hinton say, well, maybe 10 to 20%, this wipes us all out. That's not likely, but that's... Yeah. The consequence is so bad, you really have to take that risk seriously. So it's risk mitigation, risk management. I think that's an important piece not to lose sight of. And in terms of collective intelligence and how you kind of mitigate risk, well, there's inherent value, as you said, in having a diversity of perspectives. There's also a lot of value in designing the system to be safe from the beginning, rather than trying to tack on safety after the fact. And so if I can briefly explain this, the classic method right now for developing these AIs and large language models, you're using machine learning techniques where you just kind of shovel a lot of data into some algorithms, which then train up the model. And nobody really knows how the model is representing the information, right? It's a black box. And that makes the model very difficult to predict. And so you have this great semi-intelligent thing. But if you ask it how to create a bioweapon, it might very well tell you. And you say, well, that's not very safe. And so the way that this problem is addressed, we talked about constitutional AI being one way to do it, try to have an AI supervise an AI. But the more basic way that came even before that and is still most commonly used is to have a bunch of humans ask it to do bad things. And every time the model does a bad thing, they say, no, you can't do that. Don't tell people how to make bioweapons. So, oh, okay, I won't do that anymore, right? But it's kind of like a game of whack-a-mole, because you're doing the testing after the fact. You don't really know how it's representing the information or how it's going to behave. And so you're reduced to sort of this, I don't know, let's try this, let's try that. That's very inefficient. It's also very dangerous. A much better approach would be to try to design safety into the system at the very beginning. That's how we do everything else, like cars. We would design the car to have brakes, not sort of after the fact say, oh, I guess we need to add a brake, right? So so that's the approach. The way that we suggest doing it and that we're encouraging tech companies to do it is to have a collective intelligence design, because if you have multiple intelligent entities that all work together, you have sort of the makings of a democracy where you can have checks and balances. So if one agent does something that's not so good, another agent can see what that agent does and can sort of serve as a counterbalance. And the key element here is the visibility or the transparency. So Neil, you and I, what's in our heads, I can't read your head and you can't read what's in my head. And the same in society, you know, all these humans are going around, and yet we're not worried that the world's going to end, because we have rules of society and we can see how each of us acts. So our actions are visible. What we say is visible. And based on rules governing the actions, we can sort of regulate the system. In the same way, a collective intelligence system that uses AI entities and maybe human entities on a network, each action of the AI entity is visible. And if it's visible, then you can have rules and you can detect, is that good behavior? Is that bad behavior? You can have checks and balances. So it's a fundamentally different design. Instead of one giant sort of black box where you're sort of crossing your fingers that it behaves well and trying to test it like crazy at the end before you release it to the public, knowing that there's no way you're going to catch everything. That's the current way we're doing that, doing things. Instead of that, let's have a group of entities, of AIs. Each one doesn't have to be a super genius, just like on Wall Street. You didn't have to have super geniuses. That just average intelligence, large language models is okay. But if you design the network and the interaction properly, each of their actions will become visible and transparent, and you can have checks and balances built into the system the group will be very intelligent. Many minds are more intelligent than one, many entities more intelligent. You can reach that high level of intelligence, but in a much safer path that's more democratic and also more representative of all the people. Because as we spoke before, if these entities are personalized with our values and ethics, then that entire system will be reflective of a much broader group of human ethics.
And we will have a diverse set of people listening to our conversation today from all over the world. There'll be some that will be risk averse, some more cautious, some may be afraid and fearful of the road ahead. And there are indeed debates on whether AGI should even be developed, whether through self-alignment, engineering design or hybrid approaches. So where do you see the technical and indeed philosophical limitations of letting systems teach themselves values through opaque processes, for example?
Well, let's see. The first thing I have to say is I'm a little bit of a pragmatist. So in an ideal world, I think we would probably pause, and there have been calls to pause AI development so that we could think through these issues because, you know, this is the most powerful technology that's ever been invented by humans. It's very clear to me and to many others that that's true. And so ideally, you'd want to proceed cautiously. That's not going to happen. The pragmatic side of me, I've spent too much time in Silicon Valley and talking to folks on Wall Street, and I know that the forces of capitalism and competition are alive and well, and there's no way people are going to slow down. You know, if Google slows down, then maybe OpenAI won't, right? And so competitively, they're forced, even if they wanted to go slower, they would have to go faster. Similarly, if the US were to regulate, China might not. Again, you have that competitive dynamic. So that's the reality we're in. And so my approach has been to say, let's not fight that. Let's just accept the world as it is. We're going to have this arms race or this AI race. So how do we try to make it as safe as possible? How do we guide it to a safe path? And sort of the way I think about that is not black and white. Again, my experiences on Wall Street probably have shaped this thinking. In Wall Street, in order to be a successful hedge fund, you only have to be right 51 or 52% of the time. You don't have to be right on every trade. You just have to be very consistent, you know, across time. And basically, the game is to shift the odds a little bit in your favor. It's all about probabilities and shifting the odds one way or the other. Similarly, with AI, there's a certain risk and a certain chance that it kills us all. I don't know what it is. I think it's low. I think it's much more likely that it's great. But nevertheless, any risk is too much. Any single digit risk even is too much. So how do we shift the odds so that it's lower? If the risk was 10%, how do we make it 9% and then 8%? Like, that's the game that we're playing. And I think there are things that can be done. In terms of technical limitations, philosophical limitations, I have one thing to say on the philosophy point, I guess. I am not a philosopher by training, but there are some people much smarter than me that have said some intelligent things that I'd like to repeat. So one of them, Herb Simon, who I mentioned before, one of the 11 scientists who named the field of AI back in 1956 and built one of the very first creative AI systems at that time, in the 1980s, wrote a little book called Reason in Human Affairs. And something has always struck me about that little book. There's a sentence in there where he says about reason or logic, reason is wholly instrumental. It cannot tell you where to go. At best, it can tell you how to get there. And by that, he meant that there is no logical way to derive what is right and what is wrong. And it turns out, I traced it back, this goes all the way back to David Hume, a famous Brit, who in 1776 wrote a treatise basically saying there's no such thing as oughts, meaning what you ought to do, based on is-its, just based on facts. So you can't, there's no logical way to take a set of facts and say, this is what I should do. The what you should do, the values, has to come from somewhere else. It's subjective. That's very optimistic, in my view. It's a ray of hope, because it means in the future, if you have artificial intelligence, super intelligence, that's a trillion times or a million times smarter than Neil or I, there's no logical way. This is going to be a logical system. There's no logical way it can derive this is right and this is wrong. It's got to get those values somewhere. And where do humans get the values? We don't get them logically either. We get them from our peers or our parents, from society. And so it's my hope that humans can influence the AI, at least initially, to have human-aligned values. And I think that's very likely. That's the most likely case. And all of our data, as we mentioned earlier, everything we do is data for these AIs. That is basically giving those AIs that initial value set. And because there's no way that logically they would say, oh, I've concluded this is right and this is wrong. You can't do that based on logic. They could change their mind about, you know, what's the right thing to value, but they're not going to do it based on logic. There's a great chance that we can influence it to be human aligned. So that's kind of as far as I go on philosophy, what I've used to sort of help me, I guess, in these design discussions.
And you made a few great points there around the pace of innovation around AI. And you've seen firsthand some of the drivers in Silicon Valley. And there's an old saying, I think it's the US innovates, China often replicates, and Europe regulates. And here in Europe, they're often accused of playing it safe, maybe too safe, maybe safe to its detriment, and the fear of getting left behind because they're being so safe and over-regulating. It's quite a tricky balance to get right, isn't it?
It is. I think the tricky thing is that safety is usually seen as opposed to going quickly and profit motive. And yeah. Myself, I just said a few minutes ago, if in an ideal world, we would pause and go slowly. But we're not in an ideal world. So the question is there a way that you can actually have a safer system that goes faster and that's more profitable and that's more powerful? And I think if there was an approach that offered both, that would be like having your cake and eating it too. I think the Silicon Valley guys would go for that. I think Europe might go for that. I think the entire world would like that. And I think that's what those are design constraints that we at superintelligence.com and IQ have taken. We can only offer a solution that's much safer, but it also has to show the promise of being more profitable and faster. And it's very lucky because if you think about it, it is faster actually to assemble a superintelligence from lots of existing components, from existing entities. They're already built. You don't have to train new ones. So that's going to be faster. It's going to be more profitable. It's a lot less expensive than building huge data centers and, you know, spending hundreds of billions of dollars to try to train one big giant black box that's very dangerous. A better way is to take these existing things, figure out a way to hook them together so that they can get to that level of intelligence at a lower cost, much more quickly, and in a much more transparent and safe way. So I think it is, if you look at the problem differently, sometimes it's possible to have your cake and eat it too. And that's the message that I'm trying to get to those tech leaders. Hey guys, there's another way to do it. Can make you lots of money, and it can be safer than what you're currently doing.
So on the subject of having your cake and eating it, when you're talking about intentionally designed intelligence, how do you explain that idea, that concept to business leaders, many of which might be listening today, are trying to move fast with AI, but they also want that confidence that the systems they deploy will behave predictable and beneficial or in beneficial ways. How do you get that message across?
Well, I think there's the design piece, and that's fairly well recognized, at least in software development and software quality. So in a prior life, you know, my first job out of grad school was IBM, and I ended up writing a book there on software quality. I can distill that entire book to one sentence, which is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's the field of software quality in a nutshell. And what IBM found was if you spent an extra dollar, for every extra dollar you spent in designing things, thinking more carefully about the design, it saved as much as $10,000 if you didn't do that. And then a bug came and it was shipped and you had to pull back the software and placate the customers and all that kind of stuff. And so there was this huge benefit to trying to prevent problems rather than fixing them later. And I think most tech leaders are aware of that. What they may not be aware of is that there's a way to do this with AI because there's a certain paradigm. And I understand why it emerged. This is one of the benefits of being in the field so long is you've seen the trends. AI started out as symbolic AI, where you program in all the rules In the 80s, they developed ways to do machine learning where you don't have to program in the rules. It'll just learn them. The downside was you're not quite sure what it's learning. And then by the time we got to 2012, and certainly by 2022, when ChatGPT was released, the entire field had shifted towards, let's not program in the rules, let's just let them learn it, because the GPUs and the processing power was so fast that that approach was actually feasible and you're getting these great results. And then at that point, people stopped thinking about all the other parts of AI, at least a lot of people did, and they thought all of AI was machine learning. It comes with a black box, that's just the way it is. That's not the way it is. There's plenty of AI systems that have been developed in years past, and there's plenty of hybrid systems where you can build transparency into it. You have to design it in. And now as there's a move towards AI agents and reasoning systems, it's kind of funny for me to watch from afar to see the entire field shift back. It's like, oh, we don't have to just sort of have machine learning make this black box. These systems are going to reason like people. Yes. And so maybe that reasoning can be made transparent. And maybe you can have collective intelligence of multiple systems, which is an old idea that goes all the way back to Marvin Minsky in the 80s. He wrote a book called The Society of Mind, which was basically saying we can have a really high level of intelligence emerging from a collection of much less intelligent things. I mean, and he was one of the pioneers. So these original scientists, which unfortunately some of them or most of them have now passed away, they actually thought through these things. And it's a matter of just rediscovering some of these ideas. And in the rush, I think a little bit of it has been forgotten.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think when we talk about super intelligence or planetary intelligence, many people become skeptical or assume, hey, it's way off, it's far in the distance, or it'll never happen. And I would also argue that most people overestimate what they can do in a year and underestimate what they can achieve in 10 years. So from all your research, from all your experience, are there any signals that organizations or business leaders listening should be paying attention to right now? And how do you see these ideas influencing AI strategies over the next few ideas? And I appreciate I am asking you to look into a crystal ball of sorts, but what are you looking at, and what do you recommend other people be looking for?
I have a pretty clear, it may be right, it may be wrong, but it's very clear in my own mind, sort of idea of the sequence of development. So I can tell you the sequence that I see. The timing is always a little harder to know exactly when each stage is reached. But the sequence that I see has started with narrow AI systems. So narrow AI just means AI that's good in a very narrow area. Think of chess. Yeah. Like you can beat the world champion at chess. And in some ways, we have already achieved a super intelligence in those narrow fields, because the best chess AI, you know, just wipes the floor with the best human. There's no contest. There's nobody debates that there's even a possibility that the best human can beat the best chess AI. So in narrow areas, AI is already much more intelligent than humans. So then the next step on the road of development here is getting it to be general, not just in one narrow area, but how does it do everything that a human can? That's AGI. I don't think we stay at AGI very long. And I think that's part of the reason that people used to talk about AGI, and now it's like almost a footnote, and they're talking about superintelligence or artificial superintelligence, ASI, because they realize once you get to AGI, one of the things you can have the system do is improve itself. Mm. And when it's improving itself, sort of at the speed of light, 24/7, never eating, never sleeping, and you've made, you know, 1,000 copies of it, it's like having 1,000 AI scientists as smart as the average human, all improving the AI, it's not going to say as smart as the average human very long. It will very quickly progress to superintelligence. And then from there, the next step that I see is sort of a network superintelligence. You have a variety of superintelligences. I think they network together. This is a natural thing. And then ultimately, you'll have it at the planetary level. So that's kind of the sequence that I see happening. In terms of where we are on that sequence, if we zoom in, that's kind of the very 100,000 foot view. If you zoom in and look in more detail, just centered around this point in time, I think 2 years ago, you saw just large language models. People were aware of AI agents, but not really. I went to AI conferences and I would say, hey, what about AI? Oh, that's a good idea. We should put that on our list. Then last year, a lot of people were beginning to do AI agents. AI agent frameworks came out. This year, everybody's doing AI agents. And so the key thing about AI agents is it basically marks a shift from, and this is pretty profound, from a tool to an entity. And something that happened recently, I'll comment on. So NVIDIA has an annual conference, GTC,
yeah,
which is their big developer conference, happened in Washington, D.C. Just a few weeks ago. And sort of like a third into that, you know, hour and a half presentation that Jensen Huang, the CEO, gave, there was a little 30 seconds where he said, people are thinking of, you know, AI as a tool. And he's, you know, but it's not a tool. It's work. It's workers. He actually said, the first time I heard a major leader like that on stage sort of say, AI is not a tool. It's essentially an entity. It's a worker. It's an intelligence. And that's very different because never before in all of human history have we created entities. We've always created tools. That's what all of our experience is with from the Stone Age on up, you know, arrowheads and hitting two rocks together and steam engines and locomotives. It's all been tools. And the thing about a tool is you're in control of the tool. You can turn it off and on. And the human is the intelligence. And this is a tool that the human uses. A technology. It may be very sophisticated like an airplane, but it's still a tool. Mm. Not anymore. And the leaders are now beginning to say this publicly. It's not just a tool. It's a worker. It's an entity. We have no experience with intelligent entities. And if you listen to Hinton, and I totally agree with this, that argument of once you get to a certain level, it just gets faster, smarter and smarter and smarter. This is not just an entity, an intelligent entity. It's an intelligent entity that will rapidly become smarter than us. We have zero experience with that. So that's a big shift to hear that acknowledged publicly. It's kind of tells you where we are in that timeline. People are realizing that we're moving from tool to agent, you know, intelligent entity. And from there, to have an intelligent entity that's smarter than you is not that big a leap, even though it sounds kind of like science fiction. I agree. I have trouble sometimes believing that I'm not writing a science fiction novel, yet I know my logic tells me that this is happening.
Love it. And one thing I think we should highlight is there's also a cultural and political dimension to much of what we're talking about today. And since collective intelligence requires such broad participation, how do you envision businesses, governments, and citizens all contributing to the values that shape future intelligence systems? And any risks that you see here if they don't? I mean, I was looking on my newsfeed today around AI bias is impacting women in the workplace as a bias against women there. But what are you seeing?
There definitely are biases. So the kind of basic rule that any first-year computer scientist knows is garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
And the flip side of that is good stuff in, good stuff out. People forget about that, but that's also true. And so the data that these systems are trained on has a huge effect. Now, I think early on, it was a situation where you had a small group of people at a, you know, frontier lab training the model, and they were choosing what data to put in. And if you had a group of maybe well-intentioned white males that were just sort of oblivious because they were techno nerds or whatever to a lot of the social and political implications of what they're doing, they might select data that was sort of reflective of what they thought the world was like. And it's not, right? The world's a very diverse place. And you can get biases, or you can have just simple things of training an AI on court records going back in time. But, you know, there were periods of time where there was rampant discrimination and everything, and that will be reflected in the court records, and the AI will learn that. So the data that you choose to train the AI on is really important. Now, the good news, in my view, is that increasingly, as these systems are used by more and more people, you're automatically getting sort of a broad input from lots of people, because all of the companies are trying to extract as much juice as they can out of every human. You know, if Neil says something different than what, you know, 100,000 other people have said, that's important. That's going to be really important, because that's the unique information that you bring to the table. And the same with me, and the same with all of us. So I believe that over time, naturally, unless it's artificially constrained in some way, these systems will sort of inherently become more reflective. But I think there are designs that can make that much more likely. If it was an open source design, if companies realize they can make a lot of money by allowing people to personalize their AI with their own expertise and an individual's own value system, then that could also be very helpful in terms of, you know, bringing more values, representative values in. And I think it's got to be sort of localized by culture and by geography. I mean, different countries and cultures have different expectations of what's right and wrong. It's got to be complicated and messy. But, you know, I don't think it will be any more complicated and messy than we already have with humans. Already, it's a complicated, messy world. And there's a lot of problems, I think, I'd be the first to admit. At the same time, we haven't killed each other completely. And that's really what I'm gunning for. No human extinction, right? Let's increase the odds of human survival. Then we'll figure out how to work out all these problems. So.
I'll drink to that, my friend. And for everybody listening that would like to carry on this conversation, find out more about you and your work, maybe even get in touch with you or your team, where would you like to point everyone listening today?
So our main website is superintelligence.com, pretty easy to remember. And there are a lot of videos, 3-minute videos that people can watch that are kind of educational. There's research papers. If you're an AI researcher, you can go all the way down to the technical patents, which we're sort of giving to the world on how to do some of these designs. And there's articles. So there's a variety of things. There's also links to contact. So that's probably where I would send folks. And I would also say, whether or not they go to the site, just remember, every time you're behaving online, that's data. So people tend to think, oh, it doesn't matter what I do. No, it does matter. I can tell you from running Predict Wall Street and those millions of retail people, when you ask them, oh, I don't really know what I'm saying. I don't think this matters, my opinion about the stock. No, those little opinions they didn't think matter beat the top guys on Wall Street. So what you do does matter for sure.
Wow. And I think that is a powerful moment to end on. And I think just talking to you today, your infectious enthusiasm, a real breath of fresh air of pragmatism and optimism thrown in as well. And I know bad news sells, and that's why we have so much bad news in there. We've got polarization online, and we focus on the bad stuff, the garbage in, the garbage out. But I love how you flip that around today and reminded everyone that good stuff in, good stuff out. And I think that is such a powerful takeaway and really needed right now. So thank you for joining me today.
Neil, thank you very much for having me.
So I hope this conversation leaves you thinking as much as it did for me, because Craig's calm realism, his optimism, his pragmatism, and he's insistent that good behavior from all of us becomes good behavior in our systems certainly offers a refreshing way of looking at AGI, a way that is neither alarmist nor naive. And I think it's so rare to hear someone speak so openly about risks and probabilities and the design choices that are shaping the future. And it's even rarer to hear that level of honesty paired with such a practical hope and optimism for what intelligent systems could become when they draw on the values of billions rather than just a few. So if Craig's perspective sparked something in you or challenged a viewpoint you held, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Should future AI systems be designed collectively? Is it realistic? And how should your business prepare for a world where AI shifts from just being a tool to an intelligent actor in its own right? Please send me a message on LinkedIn or drop me a note on the website, which is just techtalksnetwork.com. And as always, thank you for lending me your ears of curiosity. So LinkedIn, X, Instagram, just at Neil C. Hughes. Tell me, what ideas or what concerns did today's discussion stir in you? And where do you stand on the road towards a more human-aligned intelligence? Let me know. I'll be back again very soon with another guest, and we will continue to explore AI at work. Speak with you next time. Bye for now.